I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Earlier this month, a monitoring station in Hawaii announced that it had measured record levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, 400 parts per million. Similar levels were measured last year in the Arctic. These elevated numbers are of great concern to climate scientists because of the relationship between CO2 and climate change. We're going to talk about what this means and where the public stands on global warming, but first, the tragic news from Moore, Oklahoma. Yesterday, a powerful tornado destroyed much of the Oklahoma City suburb and killed 24 people, at least so far. Joining us are Gavin Schmidt. He's a climate scientist at the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, also the author of Climate Change, Picturing the Science, co-authored with Joshua Wolf. Gavin Schmidt, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's nice to be here. Thank you for having me on.
You're very welcome. Also with us, Anthony Leiserwitz, director of the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication and research scientist at the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale University, also the publisher of the Yale Forum on Climate Change and the Media. And Anthony Leiserwitz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well. Nope, we will try to get him on the line. Gavin, let me begin with you, and I know you're not a tornado expert, but I have a couple of basic questions about what happened yesterday in Oklahoma. This tornado being called an EF4, what does that mean?
So tornadoes, like hurricanes, are graded on an intensity scale, which is supposed to give you an idea of how much damage they will do. An EF4 is one notch below the very highest, which is a 5, but it has winds associated with it on the ground of up to 200 miles an hour. So it's extremely damaging, my heart goes out to the people that were affected yesterday. I was watching that yesterday, and it was just... it's just heartbreaking.
It's heartbreaking. You know. It's horrifying. It's shocking to see how much damage can be done in such a short period of time.
Absolutely. I mean, the phenomena, you know, as a scientific phenomena, tornadoes are fascinating. You know, I mean, you can see this structure, trying to understand what's going on, and you know, people who work in the Severe Storm Center in Norman, Oklahoma, and for NOAA do a fantastic job trying to pull this stuff together. But it's really hard. Obviously, it's very difficult to get information from inside tornadoes, despite what you might see in the movies. It's just a very, very difficult scientific problem.
And help us understand, I guess, some of the basic science. It's a kind of a vacuum, right? That it both can lift things off the ground and then crush things as well.
It's not a vacuum. It's just when you, like in a bucket, when you stir a bucket, and you can see that when it stirs, there's a dip in the middle, and you've just got lower pressure there. And so when you've got low pressure in the middle, then it'll lift you up. And then the actual speed of the winds around the edge are what does most of the damage. You get tornadoes when you get two main things. You have to have this cold, dry air coming in, mostly from over the Rockies, and then you've got this kind of warm, humid air that's come up from the Gulf of Mexico. And where these collide, you can have extremely severe convection. So this is when, you know, the air at the bottom becomes unstable, and it you know, lifts up, and you get these big, you know, cumulus clouds. And where that happens, right, it happens very, very intensely, and you have rotation in the cloud, then that rotation can interfere with the kind of the shear, so the different speed of the winds at different levels, and that creates this kind of very unique phenomena that creates the seeds for tornadoes. But you know, we see these so-called supercell storms. They don't all give tornadoes. Actually, forecasting when a particular supercell cloud will produce a tornado is very difficult. I mean, yesterday they had I think a 15-minute warning before it touched down. So there's a lot of science that's still to be done in trying to understand why these tornadoes appear when they do, and how to have better forecasts of what's going on.
Anthony Leiserwitz, let me get you in on the conversation, and thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. It's great to be with you.
And nice to have you with us. And I think most of us, myself included, riveted to the TV coverage of what was happening in just outside of Oklahoma City. How do you think the media did in its coverage of this tornado?
So far, I think they've quite rightly focused on the tragedy itself, and I think that's exactly where the attention needs to be. Is this has just been a horrific rending of people's lives and and their community, and we need to focus on immediate response and recovery, and helping people get back on their feet as quickly as possible. So overall, I think the media has done a good job of focusing on the tragedy.
Would you agree with that, Gavin?
Yeah, I mean, it should be clear to listeners that we'd arranged to have this this discussion about climate change way before the events of yesterday, and
yes.
So we're now talking about the tornado because it just happened, and obviously you don't have tornado experts on the line all the time, but I think it's really clear that it should be made very clear that we're not here because we're talking about climate change in the wake of a tornado. I think that that kind of dynamic just makes scientists look like they're ambulance chasers, which is just appalling.
Let me just stop you there, because I think you made an important point, and I just want to underscore it. What you're saying is that we meaning you and other climate scientists, can't say that because we have a horrific tornado that's because of global warming or climate change itself.
Yeah, no. I mean, the science of how climate interacts with extreme events, including tornadoes, including hurricanes, heat waves and things, in different aspects, it's kind of progressing, but it's still very, very early days. And, and people that are using, extreme events to get publicity for climate change, sometimes points can be made that are useful, but oftentimes it just seems a little opportunistic.
Well, let me go back to you, Anthony Lazarowitz, and I wonder, even when it comes to public opinion, when there are extreme weather events, how does that affect public opinion?
It does affect public opinion, and I guess there's a number of things to be said here. I mean, first of all, when a tragedy like this happens, immediately in many people's minds comes the question of why. Why did this happen? And there's this very human tendency to try to say, this tragedy happens, it's this giant, seemingly unusually extreme event, and then people will say, yes, but there's this thing called climate change out there. Perhaps the two are linked. In this case, there really is no science, to my knowledge, and Gavin can speak to this as well, that sees any relationship between climate change and what's happening with tornadoes in the country. That said, there are other types of extreme events, such as droughts, extreme heat waves, massive precipitation events and so on, that this country has experienced in the past 2 years. And what we've seen is that many Americans are beginning to connect the dots between all these extreme weather events and climate change. 2011 was an all-time record-setting year of extreme weather in the United States, followed only by 2012. And so as people see one extreme event after another, natural disaster after another, they are quite rightly thinking to themselves, hey, could this have anything to do with climate change? And our surveys tell us that a majority of Americans are actually starting to think that climate change is making these things more severe.
And is there some truth to that, Gavin Schmidt?
Yeah, I mean, people's sense of vulnerability, I think, changes when something like Hurricane Sandy or Katrina happens. People mostly don't go around their daily lives thinking too much about the weather, other than what should they wear, should they carry an umbrella. We don't see ourselves as vulnerable, generally speaking. And then suddenly something like this happens, and then suddenly our vulnerability to the forces of nature, as it were, becomes very clear to people. And then that causes people to kind of reevaluate other things that are going on in nature, and then climate change is one of those things that we're doing to the system. And then they say, maybe I'm actually vulnerable to climate change as well. And that's not a terrible thing to be thinking, and it's not irrational, because we are vulnerable in ways that we mostly don't pay attention to.
Well, the reason we invited you both on the show was actually to talk about a news item that didn't get a lot of attention. And this was what I said at the very top of the hour, that a monitoring station in Hawaii announced it had measured record levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, 400 parts per million. And that's the reason why we wanted to do the show. And Gavin, what's the significance of that?
Well, it's interesting that you called it a monitoring station. You should kind of point out that this is the monitoring station. Back in the 1950s, people were very concerned that we didn't actually have proper monitoring of what pollution was going on in the atmosphere. And so there was this concerted effort to put a monitoring station up on Mauna Loa, which is one of the tall volcanoes in Hawaii, so that they could measure, you know, kind of clean, pristine Pacific air coming across the Pacific for, you know, to measure these levels of carbon dioxide. And that was set up by Dave Keeling, and he was a real pioneer of monitoring the Earth system. It was the first proper monitoring of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and that's been going since 1957, so that's over 50 years they've had continuous monitoring through many difficulties in continuing funding and all the rest of it. So that record, the Keeling curve, really is a testament to how much carbon dioxide has been changing, and it's been changing, you know, year on year on year on year. It's been going up and up and up as we've been increasing our emissions, and so this month it kind of crossed that psychologically important threshold of 400 parts per million, which, you know, is just kind of a number, you know, like people, well, what does that mean? What does that mean? Oh, yeah, well, let's put it in context. Since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, it's increased 30%. So it used to be around 280, now it's 400. And as far as we can tell, it hasn't been at 400 since perhaps the Pliocene. So that's about 3 million years ago, and maybe even 10 million years ago. I mean, we're talking about a change that is geologically important. You know, most of the stuff that we do is not going to be around for very long, but the changes that we've made to the carbon cycle, that's going to be seen in the imprints in the rocks and in the ocean sediment for millions and millions of years. I mean, we're doing something that's on a scale of, you know, the planet's and planetary history. It's really quite impressive.
Well, and about a minute away from our first break here, and Gavin, let me just go back to you, and Anthony, I have a bunch of questions for you after the break, but if we're talking about the monitoring station in Hawaii, this 400 parts per million, was that for a day? Has it been sustained at this monitoring station?
So it was the first time that the daily value had gone above that. Now there's variation from day to day. There's variation from month to month. There's a seasonal cycle. So in the spring that's the highest. But then as you know, as plants grow in the northern hemisphere, and you know, as all the leaves are growing, they're sucking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So carbon dioxide will go down for a few months now till October, and then it will start to rise again. But if you look at the annual values, if you look at, you know, 1 May to last May to the May before that, you know, every year it's going up by about 2 to 2.5 parts per million. And that's because we're burning so much fossil fuel that the planet can't absorb it fast enough.
Well, let's take that very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Gavin Schmidt, climate scientist at the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, and Anthony Lizerwitz, director of the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Coastal Spine in South Jersey supports WHYY, providing physical therapy, spinal injections, EMGs, and minimally invasive surgery options for neck and back pain. CoastalSpine.com or 856-222-4444.
The life story of Imelda Marcos. The notorious former First Lady of the Philippines is now a fantastic disco musical by David Byrne. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Hollywood star Angelina Jolie let the world know she chose to have a double mastectomy to reduce her chances of getting breast cancer. We'll speak with a mother and daughter who faced the same dilemma.
I can wait and get cancer and then do it, or I can proactively make the decision to have my breasts removed and prevent it.
That's next time on Tell Me More.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Passage Theater supports WHYY and presents singer-songwriter Christine Lavin, bringing her stories, songs, and pre-show knitting circle to Passage Theater in Trenton, May 24th through the 26th. PassageTheater.org or 609-392-0766.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Gavin Schmidt. He's a climate scientist at the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, author of a book called Climate Change, Picturing the Science. Also with us, Anthony Leiserwitz, director of the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication. He's also a research scientist at the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale University and the publisher of the Yale Forum on Climate Change and the Media. And again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Anthony, when you're polling public about climate change, does public opinion change if you use the words global warming versus climate change? You get a different answer depending on what word you use?
Yeah, great question. It's actually something that has changed over time. So actually, we don't see big differences anymore between those two words. They've basically become synonyms for most people. But when you look within those results, you see interesting differences. So, for example, Democrats tend to see them as completely the same thing. Republicans, or particularly conservative Republicans, tend to see them as meaning slightly different things. But overall, the public, by and large, sees them as meaning the same thing. Now, there have been big arguments in the past and even strategies in the past to use one term versus another. Back in the 2000s, for instance, the Bush administration was advised to use the term climate change and not the words global warming because they didn't want to they said that global warming scared people more than the term climate change. So if you want to downplay the issue, use the term climate change and not the term global warming. But like I said, those meanings change over time, and as far as we can tell right now, they're basically synonymous today.
And where does the public stand on climate change?
Well, in our most recent survey, which was just a couple weeks ago, we found that about 2 in 3 Americans, about 63%, believe that global warming is happening. But only about half of them believe that global warming is caused by human activities and not natural causes. And an important one is that only about half of Americans say that they're somewhat or very worried about the issue, and in fact, those that say they're very worried is really only about 16%.
And why do you think that is? And then we'll get to you, Gavin.
Sure. Well, so this goes back to one of our oldest findings, and I think it's still quite prevalent out there, and this actually ties back to our earlier conversation, is that for many Americans, they think of global warming as a distant problem, distant in time, that the impacts won't be felt for a generation or more, and distant in space, that somehow they think this is an issue for polar bears or small island countries in the Pacific or maybe developing countries, not the United States, not my state, not my community, not my friends and family or the people and places that I care about. And so even for those that think this is that this issue is real and human-caused and maybe even serious, they still think of it as, okay, someday it'll happen, we'll worry about it then, it's a low priority now because we've got other things to worry about. That's where these experiences with extreme weather are starting to shift that conversation. They're starting to shift that conception because, as Gavin said before, people are increasingly recognizing that, yes, even here in the United States, we are vulnerable to this incredible power of nature and that there are certain things that we literally cannot do much to protect ourselves against.
Well, Gavin, it's Anthony is describing American public opinion about climate change. I'm thinking of those images from Beijing where you have Chinese wearing masks because the pollution is so thick. Is that part of the
right
problem with climate change, is that you can't see it or feel it or even taste it in that immediate kind of way?
There is something to that. You know, carbon dioxide is transparent. You can't see how much of it is in the air. And the impacts that it has are kind of global and diffuse but persistent. And that's very different from an oil spill, which is very immediate, or the levels of smog in Beijing, for instance, which is literally in your face.
Yes.
All the time that you're there. So there is... you know, that does add to the fact that, you know, people see it as a distant thing, that, you know, they don't notice it on their everyday life. And that's what makes it a very difficult problem. Plus the time scales involved. You know, I mean, the carbon cycle that we're perturbing has time scales of decades, hundreds of years. And so things that we're doing now, the planet is kind of still going to be catching up with, you know, in decades to come. In fact, we still haven't caught up with the situation 20 years ago. And yet we're continuing to make it worse. And so we've got this, you know, the inertia in the problem is, in one sense, it's good because, you know, things are happening relatively slowly. Like, I mean, it's a chronic problem rather than an acute problem. But because things are moving slowly, we're not doing anything about it. And so by the time things are really, really obvious that that things are kind of turning south, in some sense, it's going to be very, very difficult to turn that ship around. I mean, it's like trying to steer a supertanker, and you can see the shore coming, but you really need to start trying to turn the ship a long way before you get there, otherwise you're not going
to
make it.
And I want to pick up on that, but to you, Gavin Schmidt, would it be fair to say that climate scientists are almost unanimous when it comes to the evidence of climate change or global warming?
So, yeah, I mean, you have to break this down a little bit. So people are unanimous, and it's unequivocal that the planet has been warming. You know, there's hundreds of different data sets that demonstrate that. The attribution of that, you know, the cause of that warming, we're pretty much unanimous that's been driven mainly by the rise in carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases from fossil fuel burning and agriculture. And then kind of moving forward, it gets a little bit hazier. So, you know, so how much warmer is it going to get by 2050, 2100? You know, there are people that have different opinions about that. You know, what are the impacts of those things going to be? Then it's getting even murkier. And when you get into, you know, things like, you know, well, what's going to happen to hurricanes? What's going to happen to rainfall in my particular state? Those are areas where there's a lot of uncertainty. So, you know, what I just laid out there goes from things that we're really very, very confident about to things where we're still kind of at the cutting edge of science. And people sometimes forget that, you know, scientists don't have all the answers. You know, we're scientists because we're trying to work out stuff. You know, if we knew everything, we'd be textbook writers, but we're not. We're scientists. We're kind of there at the interface between what we know and what we don't know, trying to expand what we know. And so you're always working at that edge between, you know, the known and the unknown. And we're making progress, and we've made an enormous amount of progress in the last 20 or 30 years, and we know a lot more about climate change than we did, which hasn't dampened our concern about where we're going in the slightest.
Well, and picking up on that and going back to you, Anthony, then we'll get to some of our callers here, but looking at one of your polls, finding that only 42% of Americans believe that scientists are in agreement on climate change, why this disconnect, do you think?
Yeah, and it's long-term and it's pervasive. So, yeah, only 4 out of 10 Americans understand that most scientists think that global warming is happening. And moreover, only about 13% of Americans correctly understand that it's an overwhelming majority of Americans that that think it's happening. So, you know, as Gavin said, and there have been a number of studies that put the number upward of 95% of scientific papers and working climate scientists that all agree on the basics that he just laid out, that yes, climate change is happening, and most importantly, that it's human caused, and that there will be negative consequences. And yet, there's still great confusion among the broad public, and that's not by accident. This has actually been a very concerted campaign by certain interests, particularly the fossil fuel interests, but also some others with more ideological, political views on this issue, to sow doubt, to confuse the public. And it's actually a strategy that was taken straight out of the tobacco wars. It's the exact same strategy that the tobacco companies used to try to slow down any kind of regulation of cigarettes, is to basically keep convincing people or persuading people that the science is uncertain. We don't know if smoking actually causes cancer. We don't know if smoking actually causes any kind of other health impacts. And the longer you can delay that, the more you continue to be profitable. Unfortunately, we've seen a long, unfortunate history of major companies and some politicians who even today continue to say that climate change isn't happening, or they even go farther and claim that it's some sort of conspiracy theory. So unfortunately, that has had its impacts. And again, only about 4 out of 10 of Americans even understand that it's a majority, much less an overwhelming majority of climate scientists.
But do you also think that part of the problem is that, and this is broadly speaking, Americans are not very sophisticated scientifically. You know, when there's a cold winter, people think, well, how can there be global warming? There's a cold winter, then you get a hot summer, and then everyone thinks it's global warming. We confuse weather with climate.
We do, though it's a little more complicated than that, in that there are some people who, as you said, don't know much about the issue and will draw on their own personal experience to make up their mind. And so some people will change their mind when it's warm, and then they may change their mind back when they see an unusually cold winter and so on. So that does happen. But other people are firmly convinced on either that it's absolutely happening or they say that it's absolutely not happening. And they are more likely to draw on, say, weather events and use them to basically justify their already held belief. So as an example, when there was a bit, if you remember, Snowmageddon and Snowpocalypse.
I do, indeed. I think I used those words, but yeah,
yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, that's right. We're running
guilty
out
as
of,
charged, yes.
We're running out of terms like that. So yeah, there were certain people in the dismissive category who tried to use those events as saying, hey, look, everybody, big snowstorm, that means global warming's not happening. Well, that's not borne out by the science at all. And yet, they use it to reinforce their already preset belief.
And that's Anthony Lazarowitz, director of the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication, Gavin Schmidt, climate scientist at the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Gavin, anything you want to add to what Anthony said, and then we will get to our callers. Are you gnashing your teeth?
No, not really. I mean, that, you know, I think it's worth pointing out that Americans are not unique in this, you know, and that this has become, I think, a uniquely politicized issue in the United States. But it's not that everybody else in the rest of the world has some perfect understanding of the scientific method or everything that's going on in the scientific journals. People don't. People have a very shallow view of most scientific topics, you know, because their lives are busy. You know, they've got other things that are far more pressing that they need to think about. And I think that's totally understandable and very rational. So you can't be blaming people that they don't know everything that's in the scientific journals. I think we have more of a problem in the U.S. is that, you know, things become politicized and then everything is seen through this kind of politicized prism, which means that every time you try and talk about this subject, you know, people automatically jump to kind of tribal associations to, you know, this party or that grouping or and, you know, and that's very unfortunate. So I think that that's been a real tragedy in the U.S. That hasn't happened in other countries. And that's really been something that's really kind of prevented scientists and the interested public from kind of getting to grips with this particular problem.
Let me get some callers in. It looks like we have Joel from Northfield, New Jersey. Joel, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi.
You had discussed his survey results whereby people who believe that global warming or climate change is happening believe it's natural causes and not human causes. I'm wondering if the same group or other groups of people believe that humans can do something to mitigate the climate change because of their actions.
That's an interesting way to put it. Anthony, you want to take that first?
Sure. Most important thing to say here is that there is no such thing as the American public. We talk about that all the time, but in fact there are very different publics within the United States. And in our work, we've identified what we call global warming six Americas, six different parts of the public that each respond to this issue in a very different way. One group is what we call the alarmed. These are people who think it's happening, human caused, it's urgent, and they want to know what can I do, what can we do to solve it. That's about 16% of the public. Then a group we call the concerned. These are people who think it's happening, human-caused, and serious, but again, they think it's distant, something that we can deal with later. Then a group we call the cautious. That's about 25% of the public. They're still making up their mind. Is it happening? Is it not? Is it human? Is it natural? Et cetera. So they're kind of in a wait-and-see mode. Then a group we call the disengaged. It's only about 5% of the public, but they've they've heard of the term, but they don't know anything about it, so it's really basic knowledge that they're lacking. A group we call the doubtful, 15% of the public, who don't really pay much attention but think, eh, if it's happening, it's natural, so therefore it's nothing we can do anything about, so they don't support any action because, again, if it's natural, what can we do about it? And then last but not least is a group that we call the dismissive. It's about 13%. And these are people who are convinced it's not happening, it's not human-caused, and many of them are what we would lovingly call conspiracy theorists. They say it's scientists making up data, it's a UN plot to take away American sovereignty, or it's Al Gore and his friends trying to get rich. Many other variants of those kinds of claims. So there you have six very different responses to this issue within American society, and each of them come at it from a very different perspective.
Well, and let me toss this to you, Gavin, because you clearly laid out a worrisome scenario. But if it is caused, and clearly a lot of the responsibility goes to human activity, does that mean that humans, that would be us, that there are things that we can do to try to mitigate this problem?
Yeah, and we can do things at many different levels. I mean, we can do things at an individual level that are mostly associated with energy efficiency, getting more from what we're using, you know, driving a car that has higher mileage, using more efficient light bulbs and the like. There are things that we can do as organizations, as towns and cities. We can build better, we can insulate better, we can be more efficient about how we use energy. And then there's things that we can do at the state and federal and global level. And those involve kind of leveling the playing field such that, you know, people that are putting carbon pollution into the atmosphere end up having to pay a price for that. Right now it's free, and so people do it without thinking about it. But there really is a cost, and there's a cost in increased sea level, there's a cost in increased drought, increased heat waves, that is being paid slightly now, but will be increasingly paid in the future and all around the world. And so kind of equalizing those costs so that the people who are benefiting from the carbon pollution actually end up paying for it, that's a far more equitable way of doing this right now. And those are lots of different actions that we can take, and they will all have an effect. Whether, you know, the sum total of all our effects are going to be enough to slow global warming to the point where, you know, we can just adapt to it slowly, that's a real open question at this point.
And we're almost up in a break here, but Gavin, one of, I think, the lessons from Sandy is that we're seeing sea level rise, at least on the East Coast. I'm thinking of New Jersey.
Well, globally, we're seeing sea level rise. Yeah.
Yes, but I'm saying for people that are, you know, that actually have a house along the New Jersey shore, they're seeing the impact of sea level rise.
Yeah, they are. I mean, this sea level rise is a great thing where you can see. Well, it's not a great thing; it's a terrible thing. But it's a really interesting thing because you have small kind of continual rises, but then the increase in damage when you have a big storm is goes up much, much faster because, you know, the damage from a storm surge is all related to kind of thresholds. You know, does it get above the levee? Does it get above the step? Does it get into the subway tunnel? Does it get, you know, and so all of those things are thresholds. And as we kind of move the baseline higher and higher, we make it easier for those thresholds to get crossed, even if there's no change in the storm. If it's exactly the same storm comes along 20 years later, 30 years later, the damage is going to be much greater. Plus, we're putting stuff in harm's way at an increasing rate.
Well, you know what? Hold on to that thought, only because we have to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Gavin Schmidt and Anthony Leiserwitz. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY Westchester University Graduate Studies, offering over 70 graduate degree and certificate programs in arts and sciences, business, the arts, education, and health sciences. For more information or to submit an application online, wcupa.edu/grad. Westchester University. Learn more. Westchester University proudly supports WHYY.
To dream the impossible dream.
That's Michael Douglas as Liberace in the new HBO movie Behind the Candelabra. Matt Damon plays his young boyfriend. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Steven Soderbergh about directing the movie. Join us. To reach this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
This is my quest to follow that star.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. What if you were hired based on a computer algorithm and not after interviews with employers? It's already happening for some tech jobs. Also, how a Danish power grid experiment may change the way all of us use electricity. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowain. We're talking about the science of climate change, public opinion about climate change. Again, our guests are Anthony Leiserwitz, director of the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication, and Gavin Schmidt, climate scientist at the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Gavin, I had to jump on you because we were up on our break here. Right. Anything you want to say after? Or right now, I should say?
No, we can just go on to the next question.
Okay, that's fine. Anthony, anything you want to add? We were talking about sea level rise.
Sure. But I'd actually like to come back to the solutions that Gavin was referring to.
Fair
because
enough.
That's one of the things that we see that's also quite interesting. So even though the country is still, unfortunately, very politically polarized on the issue, we find that there's much more agreement across party lines in this country about some of the major solutions. And I'm not talking about the personal actions that are important, but in the end are only a small piece of the overall solution. So in particular, one of the main things that the country and the world needs to do is to make the transition away from fossil fuels, which unfortunately are very polluting, and the major cause of this and other problems like public health problems, towards clean energy. And we see that there's just overwhelming public support for making that transition, for greater research into clean energy sources, for greater distribution of those clean energy sources, for actually Americans getting involved directly. They want, for instance, help, government subsidies to help individuals buy more energy efficient vehicles or to put solar panels on their roofs and so on. And so, again, this goes across political parties. Mm-hmm. Really, to me, very interesting thing is there's an old phrase that there are many roads to Damascus, and that even people who are highly dismissive of climate change, and in some cases that's conservative Republicans, not all of them, but some, yet they will support many of these exact same policies towards clean energy because it resonates with their underlying values as well. In particular, the idea of America being independent and being self-reliant in terms of our energy sources and not being dependent on other countries for, the basic lifeblood of our energy system.
Well, and just to underscore what you said, and this is a brand new survey that you're the investigator for. A new national survey finds that 70% of the American public says that global warming should be a priority for the president and Congress, while 87% said the president and Congress should make developing sources of clean energy a priority. Just to underscore what you said.
That's exactly right.
Let me get, looks like Samir from Highland Park to join us. Samir, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
So I actually work with vulnerability and adaptability in Asia, and I had a question because climate change actually I sort of realized that it affects the very core of our everyday life. It sort of has ethics and values and all of these affective domains of science attached to it. And I oftentimes find that climate scientists are also part of the problem because they project themselves as experts, and then they say, okay, do this. But in their everyday life, when they have to negotiate with their homes and with their wives and with their families, what role does their in their everyday life? It is a question which needs to be answered because I do believe that there is, the whole issue lies in people's values and ethics and all those things, because that's sort of where it stands.
Yes.
I don't know, would you like to...
Sure.
I know I have little time, and I was trying to ramble through...
No. I think we got it. And let me toss it to Gavin Schmidt, the idea that scientists don't necessarily explain, I guess, effectively enough, or even perhaps, I think Samir was also saying, do they live, do they practice what they preach?
So, that, I mean, that's a very interesting point. I mean, what I find is that climate scientists in general are very much more conscious of their carbon footprint than the average person, and they try and minimize it as best they can. I just moved into a new apartment that has solar panels on the roof and greater insulation, and my electricity bills for about the same apartment that I used to have kind of went down by about 75%.
Wow.
So I mean, like, it really can make a difference if you look at like new construction that's kind of LEED certified compared to what was being built 40, 50 years ago. I think the caller perhaps is expecting a little bit too much from climate scientists. I'm not here because I'm trying to kind of rule the world, or I'm trying to be a kind of climate messiah or anything. People ask me to talk about climate science because that's what I study. I study climate science. I've been doing so for about 20 years, and people ask you because they want to know about what's going on with the world. But there's a big difference between knowing what's going on with the world and suddenly having all the answers to how we should deal with that information. Mm. And that is rightly, it's a values question, it's an ethical question, but it's also a conversation that everybody should be having. It's not something where people should just be paying attention to what I say or just following what I do, but we need to think about these things as a society. That's what politics is for. Politics isn't a bad thing. Politics is there so that we can work out amongst ourselves what the best course of action is. And when we live rightly in a democratic society where people's values and ethics mm-hmm. can be debated and talked about, the science of climate is just one input into that, right? And that's what I'm an expert on. I'm not an expert on how people should live their lives. I try and tell people the things that are affecting this problem. Eating meat is affecting this problem. Burning coal is affecting this problem. Burning oil is affecting this problem. Using solar energy is helping this problem. Those things are scientific questions. I can just say, okay, this is not. They're not value questions, which are the kinds of things mm-hmm. like, what should we do about it? And I'm happy to, be part of that conversation. We need to have that conversation with the caller and with everybody else. It's not that, my values should trump everybody else's values. But I know more about science. I don't know more about ethics.
Samir, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I wondered to you, though, Anthony, when you're doing surveys, how, if you tap into the kind of values that Samir was talking about.
We do to a great extent, and of course there are a lot of different values at play here. So, one of the ones that's actually quite important is the sense of waste. Actually, across the board, Americans as a whole think that wasting things, wasting money, wasting energy, wasting lives, etc., is wrong. I mean, there's pretty much unanimous social agreement about that. And in many ways, that is what we're doing. We are wasting energy. We are not a particularly efficient society. For all of our wonderful advantages as a country, we're actually not one of the more energy efficient or less wasteful energy users compared to many of our peer countries in Europe, in Japan, Korea, et cetera. There's much that we can do just systemically. And I want to come back to Samir's question and to Gavin's point, too,
sure.
about and my experience is absolutely the same as Gavin's, is that, I think the vast majority of scientists I interact with do take this very seriously. They do see that they are part of this issue, and they're doing what they can personally. But they also recognize that we're all embedded in these broader social systems. I would love to be able to take a high energy efficient bullet train from New York City to Los Angeles, but I can't because my country hasn't given me one. By contrast, countries like Japan, China, have made those kinds of options available. Unfortunately, here in the Northeast, I'm still creaking along with an energy system that is mostly oil-based, often coal-based, et cetera, and goes down when you have a big storm like Sandy or snowstorm Nemo and so forth. So, you know, we have to deal with the fact that we have inherited these big social structures that need to be improved. They need to be transformed into something that's worthy of the 21st century. That's ultimately what we all have to do.
Let me get some more callers in. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. I see what's Candida from Springfield, Pennsylvania has to say. Candida, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I want to ask about the oceans, and more specifically, there's a lot of, I don't know what they're called, but there are small microorganisms in the ocean that I think are supposed to produce a third to a half of all the oxygen in the atmosphere. And my understanding is they're under threat because of the CO2 going into the ocean and the acidification of the ocean. They may not be able to survive.
Well, Candida,
my question is, sure, because of this acidification of the ocean, is anybody monitoring these small organisms to find out if they're still in the number that they were before and whether they're affecting the oxygen level in the atmosphere?
Candida, thanks for the call. Gavin, do you want to take that?
That's a great question, and it points to a number of things. One is that climate change is having an impact on many, many different aspects of the planet, and the oceans obviously are a very large part of the planet, and we are seeing impacts there. We're seeing impacts because of ocean acidification, so that's the carbon dioxide is dissolving in the water, and that's making the water a little bit more like carbonic acid, a little bit more acidic, and that's making it more difficult for creatures that make shells, like whelks and mussels, to kind of pull out the carbonate from the water to make their shells. So that's a problem. We're seeing changes to the stratification, so you know how warm the water is and how much mixing there is that brings up nutrients for fish and for biomass. We're seeing changes there. We're seeing changes to how salty the water is because there have been changes to rainfall patterns. And to sea ice patterns in the Arctic. And we're monitoring these things mostly by satellite. So I work for NASA, so we have a very good monitoring program for what's called ocean color. And if you look at these pictures, what you can see are, kind of green blooms where there's a lot of biological activity. Those are the small little creatures that you're talking about, the plankton, the blue-green algae that produce, that have a lot of photosynthesis. They produce a lot of the oxygen that we breathe. And we can see those patterns. We can see them, bloom and then dissipate and then move around with the ocean currents. And we are monitoring those from space. We haven't seen any big changes in terms of the trends in those measurements so far, but obviously we're monitoring those things very, very closely. Like oxygen, it turns out there's quite a lot of oxygen in the air, and so we don't really need to worry too much about the oxygen running out. There's really quite a lot of oxygen around, and so that's kind of 1,000-year, 2,000-year kind of time scale for that to change. So that's something that we are concerned about for the long term, perhaps, but that's not one of the more acute problems that we have to deal with.
Candida, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Anthony, have you polled or done surveys on the Keystone XL pipeline?
We have, and basically what we found just as of a couple weeks ago is that about half of Americans have heard of the XL pipeline, meaning that half have not. So it's an issue that hasn't fully resonated with the broad public yet, and I think that's really, of course, a function of media coverage.
Sure.
The more the media covers something, the more everybody knows about it and forms opinions about it. But of those that say that they're following the issue closely, and that's only about 18% because it's clearly not a top-shelf issue in most people's minds, but among those that have heard of it, about 2 in 3 currently support the project.
2 out of 3?
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. Well, and that's a decision that the Obama administration, the State Department, will be making, I guess, sometime into the future. Kevin, let me ask you about changes in temperature. And when we're looking at a global temperature change, how much temperature increase have we seen over the last couple of decades?
So what we've seen over the last couple of decades you really want to be looking at longer term. So say since the 1970s, temperatures have increased by about a half a degree to 1 degree Fahrenheit, a little bit more on land than in the ocean, and a little bit more, well, actually quite a lot more in the Arctic compared to the tropics. But people have a very hard time kind of grasping what that means.
Yes.
Because, you know, it's just a number, right? So, you know, we don't notice that when our temperature in our house changes by that kind of degree. So why does it matter? I think an interesting point of reference is that, like 20,000 years ago, which is, I know is a long time ago, especially in today's 24-hour news universe, right? 20,000 years ago, we were in the middle of a big ice age that was driven mainly by wobbles in the Earth's orbit, and the temperature of the whole planet. You know, we had these huge ice sheets. So, you know, Pennsylvania was just the kind of edge of the bottom of those ice sheets, and they stretched all the way from New York all the way up to the high Arctic. The temperature of the planet was only about 8 to 10 degrees colder than it is now.
Huh,
right. So the kind of scale for planet temperature goes from, like, you know, minus, you know, like 10 degrees colder than now to, you know, 10 degrees warmer. And we are, you know, we've already gone up one, and we're expecting 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe 10 degrees by the time we get out to 2100. And that's the same kind of scale as the difference between today and the Ice Age, right? But in the other direction. Right, those are planet changing numbers, despite the fact that they just seem to be kind of small and irrelevant. We don't notice those kind of changes on a daily basis, but the planet definitely notices.
Well, we have to end on that note. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Gavin Schmidt, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Anthony Lazarowitz, thank you very much as well.
Thanks, Marty. Great to be here.
Nice to have you both here. Anthony Lazarowitz, director of the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication, a research scientist at the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale University, and the publisher of the Yale Forum on Climate Change and the Media. Gavin Schmidt is a climate scientist at the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies and wrote a book called Climate Change, Picturing the Science. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour, but stay with us. We'll be right back.